It's August 31st in Singapore, and I'm talking to
Juha Kaario.
Juha, can you tell me your personal climate change story?
Yeah, I come from Finland, and you know, Finland is ice covered most of the time of the year. No, not really. But we have snow. We have snow, and we have ice covers on lakes during the winter time. So, and then we have beautiful summers. But recently, past 10 years or so, the city I'm living in, which is called Tampere, and it's between two big lakes, and especially the northern lake is something that it's just a open water, which is about 60 kilometers long and about 20 kilometers or 15 kilometers wide. And it always froze on the winter time, but the time when it froze is getting farther and farther to the winter. And past 10 years, each winter has been kind of more and more postponed. Mm. Typical time it's has been frozen in my childhood was about in November, December time frame. Now it's always in January. And I checked for records. Luckily, city of Tampere has kept the records about from some like 19th century about, you know, when it's been frozen. And in 30s, there was a it's kind of a change, a different kind of a weather. So there was a period of warm winters. So in that time, in few winters in a row, it froze quite late. And the record frozen was 30th of January. And that was recorded in 1934. Mm. And after that, you know, it's just normal. You know, yeah. November, December, sometimes in the beginning of January. But now, you know, since 1990, late 1980, it's been constantly postponed. Some years are exceptions, but you know, you can see the trend.
Yeah.
And this year actually was the why actually I woke up, because we broke the record from the 1934.
Oh.
And now it was the 21st of January that it got frozen. Hmm. And I'm expecting to see quite not eagerly, but I'm expecting that next year we might go to February. That would be a groundbreaking.
And so how does this affect you, your life or your livelihood or life in Tampere?
Yeah, actually it's kind of a symbolic value, because walking on ice cover is nice. Skiing, skating or skiing there is nice. Mm-hmm. And people have a tradition. There's a lighthouse quite close to city center, about only 2 kilometers walk on ice, which is a very popular place to have a picnic on Sunday, you know, March, you know, nice, mm-hmm. nice sunshine. And there's this kind of a traditional walk which local newspaper organize every year, and you know, it just goes away.
Mm-hmm. So,
but for the community, I don't think it has that big economical value, but for the minor tourists like fishermen, there are a few professional fishers still on the lake providing local fish, and they do it on a, you know, on ice,
right?
And they have a techniques to so they can't practice their profession anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really this kind of professional biodiversity that is disappearing.
Yeah.
So it's emotional. It's sad.
Yeah. And what was it that inspired you to go and research the times and, you know, the weather records?
It's kind of because I'm kind of a trained scientist. I like to associate things into the some sort of a statistical format that you can improve things. But that really what inspired me was just a newspaper that now the record is coming. Oh, actually, we followed it throughout the January. Will the record
mm-hmm.
be from 34?
Mm-hmm.
Would that be breaking? And it got break. So it's kind of proof that something is really happening.
So you're studying, you're a scientist that studies climate?
Yeah, I'm actually oriented on the business side of technology, so I'm doing an MBA at the moment as executive level, and that sense I'm looking for the business impact and economical change that is happening
mm-hmm.
in climate change.
And how, you know, as a scientist, how do you see people's personal experiences tying in with the science of climate change?
I think the main word that comes to my mind is denial. In different levels. You know, everybody knows it, everybody hears it, but they want to deny it for many reasons. For example, some people say that, you know, I want to kind of burn out and then fade away, you know, let the climate change happen and, you know, I don't care. That kind of fatalism is the worst kind of denial. Then there are like more that wonder about, you know, how it affects my life and is it really that, can I do something and so on. So, but everybody's kind of reluctant to change, which is natural for humans.
Right.
And main reason then is economical, because if you change your habits, it will cost you more. And that's, I think, is the background.
Do you think that people's experiences can make a contribution to the climate science, or do you think that can be, because, for example, in the States, you always have these climate change deniers saying, well, it was cold, you know, this winter, so look, it's snowing, so there's no climate change. So a lot of scientists I've talked to have talked about how these kind of anecdotal experiences are a problem. Yeah. But I wonder if there's some benefit to people's personal experiences.
Yeah, I think there was a nice talk in a conference earlier. Can't remember. Mm. Or was it? Actually, it was, I think it was your presentation that somebody said that people's lives is so short that they can't see the big changes. I agree on that, absolutely.
Yeah.
So people don't see their, like, right. In political science, you know that the voters' memory is the shortest memory in the world.
Mm.
And I read a book about a year ago called Forgotten Environmental Problems. It was a Finnish book, so that was translation.
Yeah.
And the best part of the book showed that there are issues like noise, light, smells that are actually climate change and environmental problems, but they are not associated anymore, no longer about this climate change. And and reason is that people are forgetting things, and people have different ways to forget things. And that's that really that we there's so much information overload that we can't associate anymore these issues.
And we become adapted to our changes in climate that we feel like it's always been, this is the way it's always been, you know, in a way.
And because the change is so gradual, you don't see how much it has changed.
Yeah.
So we need some sort of way of visualizing, like graphs or some statistical data associated with the people memories, you know, photographs, video clips about during their lives or their grandparents' lives and so, to really associate that this is what has happened. And I think this is very, very important for us to understand.
And is Finland business, what kinds of things are businesses in Finland doing about this situation? Is it more about adaptation to the changes, or are they actually doing some things to try and reduce?
It varies. I think most of it is adaptation. Some companies, well, luckily my Nokia, which I'm working on, is very active on trying to change the habits and trying to enforce recycling and that kind of things. It's more, I think, still credits kind of reactive. Forest industry is a big in Finland, so they are really adapting, not really doing proper things yet. Tourism industry is reacting, and so on.
Well, I wonder if I could ask you just to one more thing, and I don't know if you have such a story, but it could be interesting to. Can you tell me a story about your experiences when you were a child with this frozen lake? Just tell me about maybe something that happened for you. Just in thinking about this idea of forgetting.
So actually, the you know, like I said, there's two lakes, and then there's the northern and then the southern lake. Southern lake is not frozen that often. It's harder to measure because there's rapids and rapid waters that actually keep a part, so much current in that lake that there's a part. But I grew actually on shore of that lake, and we used to go a lot to the ice during the winter and close to the little islands that were in the lake, which has a nice sledge hills, and it's nice walking there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes ice hole fishing and skiing, and it's not possible anymore. So it's that's kind of emotional.
Thank you for that story. I'm speaking with Isrizal, and from Singapore, and we're talking about the palm oil issue in relation to climate change.
Yeah, a lot of these landmass where they are using for palm oil cultivation is what is termed as a peat soil landmass, and peat soil is really important for with regards to flooding situation and stuff like that, because peat soil actually absorb a lot of water, mm-hmm. right? So it's actually a natural progression of how water is being retained in this, you know. So by them changing this land, peat soil, into cultivation land, it actually promotes flooding, right? And not only that, it kills a lot of living things, you know, whether it's organism or even like fishes that actually lives on peat soil. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's two on it. Then on the other side, by the coast, it is mostly like a mangrove swamp, right? And mangrove swamp is actually important as we have seen, right, in during the tsunami, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Without a mangrove swamp, right, is the mangrove swamp is actually a buffer for waves and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
So by them cutting away the mangrove swamp and in the inland the peat swamp, right, mm-hmm. for this kind of mass cultivation of palm oil, which is actually used for biodiesel, which is actually supposed to be green,
right?
Which is actually a contradiction in the sense that a lot of the indigenous people from Southeast Asia live in these places, right? They rely they've been relying on it for like hundreds and thousands of years before what modern civilization happens.
Uh-huh. Relying on the
jungle, the forest, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
for mm-hmm. the food, for their livelihood, for their mm-hmm. culture, for you know.
Mm.
So their self-determination as a group of people, mm-hmm. right, is totally being marginalized, right? And not only that, you know, there's not only they are being marginalized, yet you know, they are not even recompensated, you know. Not in what we think as a capital,
mm-hmm.
right? But how do you then recompensate a lost culture or a lost livinghood?
How did you find out about this issue?
I found out about this issue because I'm dealing with like human rights work, mm-hmm. right? But at the same time, that human rights encompasses a lot of other rights,
mm-hmm.
right? So self-determination of a marginalized group was one of the case study that I did, right? And
did you grow up in Singapore, in this area?
Yeah, I grew up in Singapore, right? Mm-hmm. But the reason why I work around the region is I see that Singapore's effect on the region,
mm-hmm.
right? Singapore is as it is, the way you see it when you are here, the way the other participants in this conference see it as it is,
uh-huh.
because of the imports, raw imports coming out from the region.
Yeah.
What Singapore is to the region is at one time as what North America was to Latin America, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Of course, now it's like North America to the world at large. Right.
Sure.
But we are also seeing that change actually, how Singapore affect not just the region but even larger, politically, culturally, even like climate change.
Are you one thing I'm asking people is about kind of their personal experience and their memories. And in the previous interview, the person talked about how forgetting can be sometimes a problem for people in terms of just accepting what the situation is like with climate, because they forget kind of the past. And I wonder if there's something in these mangrove forests or the soil or the jungle that you can remember from your past that makes you
Yesterday me and my friend Silen Pillay and Nora Zul, you know, we're talking about this last kampung or last village in mainland Singapore.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And you can see that being replicated in the region actually, mm-hmm. right? But we talk about also like the frugality of life that in these places, right?
Mm.
But what is wrong with frugality?
Right? Yeah.
Is it a frugality that is a problem, or is it that one thing more and more, you know,
mm-hmm.
demands that we make in our life that is a problem?
Is there something that you remember from when you were a child about maybe visiting these villages or
no,
in jungle?
I used to live in a village myself.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
And what happened was the land was taken away for development.
Mm.
Right? And then we are not properly compensated for that land.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there was this incident where it was four generations of us, right?
Oh.
My great-grandmother, my grandfather, my mother's generation, and me. What we did was, on the last day before we left the village, right, me and my grandfather, we actually pulled down the village, pulled down the facade of the building.
Oh.
Right? Because we rather that the land is taken, right, but we rather we see it being taken apart by ourselves,
yeah.
rather than seeing it destroyed by.
Uh-huh.
But I did ask my grandfather then. I said, you know, we as a people, you know, because I'm Malay, yeah, this is our region in a sense. We as a people, you know, we only claim to one simple life, like that kind of frugality. Right? There's nothing wrong with it to me personally, right? But look, we can't even defend it. We can't even defend that kind of life that we want. No, what is so difficult to defend a simple life?
Right.
Why is it so difficult to defend a simple life?
Yeah. What is it? What was it like compared to now, living a life in the village? Just for example.
There's a lot of things that the village life or life in a kind of. When it's close to nature, it's a kind of open source,
uh-huh.
right? But a natural open source,
mm.
right? It's kind of education that you get, you know, from the elders and stuff like that, with regards to, you know, what you can eat, what you cannot eat, the kind of animals, and stuff, you know,
mm-hmm.
That lives around the area and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's an important kind of education, actually. Right? We used to, even when there's a certain respect from the people to the land, you know, even if we want to like say we want to pee at certain places, right, we want
right.
to like pee at certain places, we usually what we usually do is to seek permission from our ancestors,
mm-hmm.
so we know that we can't destroy the nature because it's part of our ancestors.
Uh-huh.
So there's that a bottom down kind of horizontal respect.
Right.
Rather than thinking, oh, there is somebody else above who actually take care of you know, where we are living and stuff like that, about our life.
How does the process of asking for permission happen? Is it just kind of a meditation, or?
It's like we always say that, you know, like in our hearts, or you can actually, mm-hmm. I mean, when you are small,
yeah.
You are being made to say it, right? So it's like something like a literal translation would be grandpas, grandmas, you know. I'm asking permission to, you know,
right.
do my natural.
Wow, that's really beautiful.
So in a sense, there is that connection, that mm-hmm. connection, right? And you know that, you know, you can do certain things, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can destroy certain things, you know, certain plants and stuff, right? Although people may say, oh, there's a taboo and stuff like that, you know?
Right.
But what is essential in that? What lesson you can learn from that? I mean, yeah.
That's very beautiful. I think that's an important lesson for people. I hope that this comes up in some of the discussions and talking about. I think so many people are so concerned about the footprint and everything, and it's kind of nice to think, well, yes, you're going to have a footprint, but you should ask permission, or you should try and understand what that means. Thank you. It's August 31st. I'm in Singapore talking to Xing Chong. I'm sure I didn't pronounce that correctly.
Xing Chong. Yeah.
Who's from Singapore, and can you tell me your personal climate change story?
So, but can I just ask you? I mean, when you actually ask about personal climate change story,
mm-hmm.
means how?
Well, I guess on one level it can be how climate change has affected you personally in your life. Have you lived in Singapore your whole life?
Yeah, mostly in Malaysia. Malaysia and Singapore.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so some people have talked about, I guess it's kind of, there's two parts to the question, I guess, which is thinking about remembering what things were like, you know, kind of growing up and how things have changed. And for you personally?
Yeah.
Related to climate. And then also, how maybe you see the climate change issue affecting
everyone.
Everyone, yeah.
Yeah, I just find that when I was young, I mean, you can get a very, even though we are not a seasonal country in Malaysia, mm-hmm. but you can get a very good grasp of when are the period that the rains will come. Yeah, I mean, it used to be, you know what I mean? I mean, because we only have, non-seasonal. But
how often do the rains come? Like, what's the normal pattern?
Yeah, I mean, the normal pattern, actually, the rain starts to come a lot later part of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And the beginning part of the year, and probably is a time where you get a lot of sun, and it's really hot.
Yeah.
And you can actually sense a pattern. You can actually see it. I mean, you could feel it. We can tell that actually, okay, it's raining season coming.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but nowadays, you don't actually different. You can't really tell the difference anymore.
Hmm.
I mean, you get a lot of flooding.
Okay.
You get storm coming out of nowhere, without any sign. I mean, like what happened in Myanmar,
okay.
when the cyclone came.
Oh,
yeah. All these things came without any signs,
mm-hmm.
and it is very abnormal.
Hmm.
And so actually, I think that's the biggest change for me. I mean, for a non-seasonal country in Malaysia.
Right.
This part. Because we are so close to the equator.
Right.
So we get a lot of sun. But I mean, I think that's the biggest change for us in terms of the very erratic behavior of the weather nowadays. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about how people can tell, or how you can tell when a storm's coming or when it's the season?
No, the thing is that what happened now, actually, you get across the year, you can't really kind of chart that, oh, this here's a raining season, there's no such thing anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be that beginning of the year it could be like that, in the
mm-hmm.
middle of the year it suddenly become like that. And what we realize actually is that the what used to be the kind of summer, the hot period for us, becomes hotter. It becomes even hotter. I mean, there was some day that you can really feel that it's really, really hot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny. I mean, for this part of the country.
And it's not something that you remember it ever being this hot.
Yeah.
And how does that affect people in Malaysia and Singapore, and maybe you personally?
I guess I'm fortunate in this part of the world,
mm-hmm.
where we don't really have a lot of natural disaster. We don't have volcanoes. We don't have things like, you know.
Do you have earthquakes?
Yeah, not even earthquake. You see?
Okay.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
so we are not part of that. So I think the biggest impact actually is we don't really feel a lot, but for a country who's with not very good town planning, mm-hmm. I think the rain is the killing one, because you get flash flood anywhere when you have a very bad water system.
Yeah, and so people are actually dying.
Not dying, but it really affect the way you work. I mean, you can get in Malaysia, part of the highway can be flooded when the rain comes.
Right.
Yeah, and you just stop everything.
Mm.
Yeah, and it can happen in a city as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we are seeing a lot more that nowadays.
Can you tell me something, maybe a story about when you were growing up?
Yeah.
And you were experiencing the rainy seasons, or you started to understand the pattern of the rainy seasons that now has changed?
Okay. I think it has very much to tie with our school days, you see.
Okay.
Yeah, so because our education start in the beginning of the year, so we probably have it's a bit different. I mean, from the normal US where you have summer holiday, we don't.
Okay.
So we study throughout, and we probably have a short break in between, and we always associate the later part of the year as the rainy season, and that's where most of the time that we and I still remember that when I was young, as in teenage, taking bus, we always have to cross this passage, we always flood.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and we can always tell that, okay, it's coming. As in,
and school is almost over.
Yeah. I mean, you can always expect that, okay, it's raining season now, so that part of the will be flooding again.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays, you can't really tell. It might come here, no?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just very irregular.
And so what kind of work do you do with the environment? I'm assuming you're here because you're doing some environmental kind of media.
Not
work.
Really, because I work for SMU.
Oh, okay.
I'm arts manager from the Office of Student Life.
Mm-hmm.
So my job primarily looking after I manage the co-curriculum group.
Okay.
As in what the students do, not part of the curriculum. So they actually play music, they have music groups. So I mainly look after the music groups.
Yeah.
So...
Are you thinking of, are they doing some environmental kind of projects, the students, or?
No, I think it's, I think for environment project, it has to be on, I'm more for the macro.
Okay.
Yeah, it's about raising awareness.
Mm-hmm.
It's a collective effort. Yeah, it's a collective effort. I feel that when a foundation like a green, they have this Greenpeace. I mean, you have to constantly work with the government to actually to kind of spread the message.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that people might say that, oh, come on, government is slow and things like that. But I think nowadays, I mean, because everybody's talking about the climate change,
right?
And I think everybody sensed it. Yeah,
when
you could tell.
When did you first learn about climate change and become interested in?
I think, ironically, we really, ever since we have talked about, this gas that we use that actually is spoiling the ozone.
Yeah.
I heard a lot of that when I was
greenhouse
young.
Greenhouse gas.
Yeah, greenhouse.
Yeah, you heard
a
lot when you were young.
Yeah, but the
thing
is that you don't really see the effect of it, I think, until recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it took quite a long time, actually, whatever they predicted then is happening now.
Yeah.
And I think it's only then that people start, hey, these guys are serious. I mean, see what they say about 10 years, 20 years ago. I mean, it's happening now. Because I'm sure when actually the scientists, when they proposed it, it was a theory, you see. And people don't really feel it. And when people don't really feel it, they say, okay, it's okay, we'll wait. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think, for the past years, I mean, these few years, I mean, people is really start to sense it. Yeah, you have the tsunami coming and things like that. The iceberg is melting.
Mm-hmm.
You see more... And I think that is what really prompting people to feel that, hey, we got to do something about it.
Right. And so do you think that people in Singapore and Malaysia are really noticing this rainy season change?
Yes, we do. Yeah, in general, people do feel that, you can get flood anytime nowadays.
Mm.
There's no obvious raining season now. There's no so-called obvious raining season. Mm-hmm. I mean, rain come all the time. When they feel like it, I mean, it's just very erratic, nowadays.
And does this affect also the food and other types of industries?
Not really, because, now technology is so advanced.
Yeah.
I mean, For example, there's a seasonal fruit. Yeah. I'm not sure about, have you heard about this fruit called durian?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yes, yes. It used to be seasonal.
This is a spiky fruit.
Yeah, the spiky fruit, yeah, yeah. That's a very good example now. The thing is that it only come, the durian season, we call it, only come in August, September, because that's the raining season. When it rains come, it bears a lot of fruits, and that's the time where we get a lot of durian. Oh. Yeah, but nowadays, because you see technology is so advanced, they crossbreed it, and they are the fruit is so much more stronger, resilient to the weather. They come throughout the year, so you can't really tell anytime. Yeah.
So, are there festivals or events in the past during the rainy season about this fruit?
Yeah, like, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And because people associate that a certain period of the year where they get to eat durian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you won't get durian in January to June previously, but now.
Right. Now they get it all the time.
All the time.
So there's no celebration about it or interest in it.
Yeah, I think this is it just changed the way people associate with things. Yeah.
Interesting. Well.
Yeah, but yeah, I think this one.
Do you have one more?
No, I just feel that with the technology changes, it just because people like to eat durian, it's just a good example.
Mm-hmm.
So they just think of a way to make it happen all the time.
Yeah.
I find that in a way actually is killing it. It make it so
not so special
anymore. It's just like, just imagine yourself having Christmas every day. Yeah,
right,
I mean,
right.
There's no Christmas anymore, right? Yeah, I think that's what I think. About.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Thank you very much.
No problem.
It's August 31st. I'm in Singapore and I'm speaking with
Lanfranco Aceti, and I'm a researcher and associate professor in contemporary art and digital culture. And some of the projects that I have been going on at the university, they are related to the relationship between nature and culture and the role that humanity plays within this relationship. Some of the aspects that I'm most interested in are cultures of representations and behaviors. And I think that the concept of erosion is one that is becoming extremely interesting, because so far what we have looked at is the idea of humanity eroding nature through technology and science.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I'm very interested in looking at is nature eroding humanity through the alterations that have been caused by us in the environment, and therefore the change in the environment is eroding our ways of living and will be more and more changing our ways of living, and therefore we will have to change our representation of nature and with that our behaviors. And how all of this plays within the next 20, 50, 100 years, it's for me extremely interesting.
So can you tell me how you've seen nature eroding in your own life or around you?
There are all different sorts of things. For example, in the United Kingdom, there have been quite a lot of projects. I'm particularly thinking of one in Middlesex that is about the sea eroding the coasts, and you have houses falling down and etc. And there is a very interesting policy, because it's a policy of preservation, and therefore in order to preserve the natural change or the natural environment, what happens is we are also preserving the natural changes caused by pollution within the oceans. So
mm-hmm.
is that a natural behavior of nature, or it is something else,
right,
which is a behavior that has to be corrected somehow? There are areas in England that, for example, in a few years' time, they will be basically at the same level of the sea, and they already have barriers, and there are down, I mean, the land is just below these barriers,
right,
and with the seas raising, what will happen is that the barriers will not be sufficient anymore, and therefore the sea will be coming in.
Mm.
And then you have all different kind of erosions. I mean, I'm thinking in Italy, for example, we don't, there was years ago, about 20 years ago, there were sketches, and they were always saying, oh, we don't have comic sketches. We don't have the mid-seasons anymore.
Oh, okay.
And it was like, it was a really funny sketch. And so in the middle of a conversation, when nobody didn't know what to say, they would just come up with that phrase, we don't have the mid-seasons anymore. And it was like a common, you know,
right.
like a common silly thing to say, like, oh, what a lovely weather today.
Yeah.
So it was the argument, the moment to pick up some kind of argument and to discuss and etc. But it is actually true, because what has happened is the weather, of course, has changed. Italy is facing an increasingly drier and hotter summers. So you have a process of desertification that is going on at a pretty quick speed. Because I can remember within my lifetime, I mean, I'm 40 years old. I feel like an old child. But, you know, in 20 years, 25, or since I was a child, I remember these sort of changes. And I can actually, I have actually been able to, you know, to sort of see them, experience. The weather in England is the same, because I have traveled quite a lot across Europe. So, and things have increasingly changed. And people, I think what is happening is that they're not reacting as much as they could do. And it's very problematic, because a part of it is a question of culture, how we perceive ourselves, and also what is our relationship to the social.
Mm-hmm.
And
so why do you think it is that people aren't reacting?
Well, this is the reason, I think, is this one around us, which is a very capitalistic society. I'm not criticizing the concept of capitalism. What I'm criticizing is that there is a capitalism that doesn't have any sort of social relationship. Therefore, everybody thinks about themselves, and the consequence of that is, why do I have to make any effort? Because A, I'm not going to be rewarded for it. B, it's going to be insignificant. And therefore, not being the social, let's say we can call it, I don't know, glue, automatically the effort of the single person against the collapse or the erosion of the planet becomes insignificant. And towards this sort of insignificant and extremely small effort, I think that most people just give up, and they just say, well, okay, I try to do my bit, I do this very little, and that is the end of it.
When people talk about their experiences of climate change, this desertification and the hotter summers and things, do people also talk about, when I asked people in New York about this, they talked about the economics. And so when I asked people, how is climate change affecting you personally, they said, well, food costs more. And is that something that people notice in Europe?
Yeah, it is something that people notice in Europe, but they also start noticing that, for example, the costs, particularly in Italy, all of a sudden you have a need for air conditioning, which you didn't have before, because although you had hot summers, they wouldn't reach the level, or very rarely, and just in the south for a small period of time, they would reach 40 degrees Celsius.
Really?
So, yes.
Wow.
So now you are having very, very hot summers. The temperature raises, and they are for a longer period of time, and therefore it becomes more difficult for people to, I mean, they're not used to it, and you know, you have all different kind of problems, and
people dying.
Yeah,
actually.
you have the summer times that people die. You have all different kind of problems. People not used to it. You think that you can still go out for a stroll without wearing a hat, and you know, and instead of that is not possible anymore. People used to go to the seaside, and you know, sunbathe at 1 o'clock p.m. Today they don't do it. And actually, there is this sort of behavior that people go to the seaside in the morning, then they retreat the hotter hours, and then they come back again in the later hours.
Okay.
And instead, 12 o'clock, 2 o'clock, or 12 to 3 was the peak hour of the summertime, where everybody was about. It was like sort of the stroll along the beach, and et cetera, et cetera. So that, for example, changes all these. These are small behaviors that we're starting to look at. And what I think is very interesting and is very problematic is that climate change will require very strong social responses, and I mean social responses as large groups of people that answer to the problem. And what is interesting is what's happening in China at this very moment, because they're trying to eliminate the pollution in the air.
Right, for the Olympics.
Yes, for the Olympics. And there are two things that I have actually been reflecting on. And one, the first one is the Asian countries have more of a social culture. Therefore, mm-hmm. when there is a need to do something, particularly things like Singapore, China, etc., you just say that people have to behave in a certain kind of way. And generally, a large group of people
right.
will behave in
right.
that way.
Not in Italy.
Not in Italy, not in the United States of America,
all right.
not in the US, not in Europe, generally speaking, across. So this can be a very good advantage. The other problematic that I'm finding, and I think it's actually very interesting, I'm starting to think, is it democracy a useful tool, and this is a very controversial element, to deal with global change?
Right.
Or actually we're looking at a phenomenon that cannot allow such extensive debates, and actions will be have to be taken immediately and strongly, and therefore countries like, let's say, Singapore, China, that blocks for weeks the industry, is able to do that
right.
because it is, in a way, I don't want to say that it's a dictatorship, but well, Singapore officially I think it is, well, it's a less democratic country, let's say in this way. So this country may have this advantage, which is that of enforcing policies without going through the regional, local interest, but looking at a bigger picture. I think it's actually going to be extremely interesting. I mean, interesting in an English way, which also means very problematic. And an example could be the fact that in Roman times, the concept of a dictator was... it was something that was temporary. It was a role that was given to a person that was supposed to solve a specific problem. And therefore, it would take a particular power that would stop the republic for a certain amount of time
right.
in order to solve the problem. And
right.
then you would go back into the democratic process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think today, particularly, I mean, from a political point of view, because unfortunately these arguments about nature, culture, they are not separated from the politics of what is happening. I mean, particularly the past 10 years have shown that the squabbling of the democratic process may not be as an efficient tool.
I think that, you know, I would argue with that and say that in at least looking at what has been happening in the United States with taking a very long time to even accept any climate change as real, is that that was more coming from the corporatism. So I would argue that it's not necessarily democracy, because you can look at, Switzerland and what they're, maybe they're not doing enough, but they're certainly doing more than the United States.
Yeah.
And it's really the corporate influence on the democratic system that is the problematic in many cases. I mean, I can see what you're talking about, and maybe in terms of like the UN, but really, I mean, you had the UN in agreement except for the United States and Australia or China for a while, and maybe still.
That's exactly, in a way, that's exactly the problem. That's exactly touching, because what you're saying is, which is true, is the corporate interest.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that the corporate interest influence democracy.
Absolutely.
Or influence certain kind of elements of democracy. So is that an ideal democracy, or has it changed into something else?
Yeah.
My opinion is that it has changed into something else. And this does not speak about the United States, but it is also across Europe. And this goes back to a capitalism or a capitalistic approach that doesn't have any consideration of the social. And now what will happen is that social somehow, or that exploitation of nature somehow, may come back to bite us in the back.
Yeah.
And what I I sincerely, I think that losing the past 10 years, we may have to regret it. We may seriously have to regret it, because at some point, we could have done more, with more calm, with less trauma for people, for everybody, altering our lifestyles in a very little manner. The more time passes by, the more dramatic our changes will have to be, with the hope that they will be enough to reverse the trend, because actually they may not be enough anymore.
Right.
And so that's what I find worrying.
I just wonder, I mean, I did some research onto the carbon trading system that's now been in Europe for, I guess, 2 years or something, and they're looking into starting it in the U.S. And there were some interesting proposals, actually from the U.K., about people giving individuals shares in the carbon budget, and then they individuals would be able to then choose to sell their shares to these companies to pollute, or hold on to them and try to stop the CO2 emissions. I mean, I think there's a lot of problematics in terms of how are you measuring the emissions.
Actually, you could, and that's actually that's an idea that I'm kind of in favor of. So I'll give you an example.
You read that Andrew Sims,
yes.
I think, yeah.
There are several reasons why. First of all, you can make money out of it. And are the actual people that may make money out of it. But, I mean, although I don't think that that should be the main reason. But let's say it pushes people's wallet. That's one element. The second thing is that it empowers people more. For example, I'll give you an example. I go and I do the recycling weekly. So our weekly day to the recycling center is with five bags, sometimes we do two trips, and we do two trips walking. Of course, we're not carrying huge amounts. Yeah. It's a family of two and et cetera, et cetera. But that's what we do. Yeah. And we say, if we go there with the car, we have defeated the purpose of recycling. And therefore, we recycle locally around us, whatever we can during the week and et cetera. Or in the early morning when you go out and buy the newspaper and et cetera, you recycle whatever you have from the couple of days before.
Yeah.
And at the weekend, we do the major recycling, and it takes us 15 minutes to, let's say 20 minutes to go, 20 minutes to come back. It's incorporated with a snack along the way or whatever else we did.
Do you get paid for that? Do you get money for that? No,
we don't get any sort of money. Mm. We don't get anything. We just do it because we do it.
Sure.
And we try to recycle as much as possible, and you know, also being careful of things like sometimes even crazy things. Should we wash the tuna cans, aluminum cans, and et cetera?
Right, and then using
the water, and et cetera. And we were within a recycling group, and they said, well, actually, the aluminum is so expensive to make that, yes, wash them and put them in there. So you get all these sort of little feedbacks and et cetera. I go with the bus. If the bus, I'm in a particular area of London whereby I have to go up and down with bikes and etc. London is very bike unfriendly, so I don't have the bike, and I take the bus, which is still less expensive and etc. If they were electric bus, I would even welcome them more. It doesn't matter that it adds 5 minutes to my journey. Mm-hmm. So, but there is a slowness, and I don't understand why, of the government to respond. And I'm particularly surprised by things like General Motors, Ford, that should have anticipated the trend and created greener environmental technology in order to, you know, just to beat, sell more, have a better and healthier industry, and etc. And instead, till last year, they were going with the 4x4. And you just think, I mean, how short-sighted can that be? Are they paying a huge price now today? Yes. Am I concerned about it? No. And actually, I think they should even suffer more, and it should affect the population more in order to have a bigger trend to change whatever is happening. And what is interesting about that from a government point of view, there hasn't been any suitable response. And I personally, I wouldn't advocate against any bailout of these companies.
Yeah.
Which could be something that may happen at some point, because I understand, I mean, my partner is from Detroit, so I know the area very well with all its up and downs and all its social problems and etc. And of course it's going to affect more the poor people of that area. And a bailout is not going to do absolutely anything. And also what I don't understand, what I find very contradictory, or, you know, it's a capitalism in one way, when it's convenient for the big corporate business, and then it becomes socialism when they have to be rescued because of stupid decisions that they have made. Actually, well, no, you should pay the price of whatever you have done.
So let me ask you, just kind of going back to personal experiences, because I thought it was really interesting when you're talking about going to the recycling and you know, having that really be almost like a ritual in your life. Can you talk about, it was interesting, see, some of the other people I interviewed talked about how in the past they live, for example, in Singapore and Malaysia, they live much more simply, and now they live in a much more kind of unsustainable way. And I wonder if you can talk about, you know, living in Italy 20 or 30 years ago versus now in terms of that.
I'll give an example. My sister has a commute of not even 5 minutes. I have a commute of roughly 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. Okay? She takes the car.
Yeah.
Okay? So she's not a working person.
Right.
And I tried many different times and etc., etc. And that gives you basically an example. And also what is very problematic is that she has to move the car from our house, from the parking spot, and then go there and try to find a parking spot, which takes more time than just take a nice walk from the house to the office.
5 minutes,
which is, no, it is 5 minutes. Oh. It's not 20, it's 5 minutes.
Wow.
And that gives you the sort of idea of how things have changed.
So then, is that an old-fashioned mentality to drive 5 minutes, or is that something new?
No. Yeah. That's something that has become, that is new. Years ago, for example, my grandmother, she did something like 20 miles walking, roughly 15, 20 miles. No, it was about 10 miles, 10, 12 miles.
Right,
every day. Which is 15 kilometers. Mm-hmm. When she went to the market to sell some of the produce of the farm. And she went to the market in the city, in the small city that I'm from a little village. So she walked all the way down there. She sold whatever she saw she needed to sell. She bought the things that she needed to buy, and she went back home.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you walk. It takes a certain amount. It would take roughly 45 minutes, an hour walk to go, and the same to get back. And she did it. She didn't do it every day, but it was a once a week kind of a thing, and etc.
It's so similar to what you're saying about the recycling.
Yes.
It's kind of beautiful.
Yeah. And I used to go, because I was living closer a few years ago, I would walk the 40 minutes to the university and back.
Mm-hmm.
I would do actually that walk almost every day, which made me fitter. I have lost weight and all the rest of it, and etc. Then I moved to a different area. And it is actually more difficult. I'm a little bit far away. And also there are all different kind of things going up and downs. And therefore you sweat too much. You don't have a walk.
Right.
You actually have hills that you have to climb.
Mm.
And because of social issues, you cannot arrive at work sweating and then affect people around you.
Right.
There are no showers that a willing person could say, oh, okay, let's go and take a shower.
Mm-hmm.
There are no bathroom facilities of such whereby you could say, okay, I'll just take a torso wash,
which
is armpits and etc. quick. I use a bit of I don't actually use not even air sprays anymore. I have a stone which basically acts as a disinfectant, because those are bacteria. So I use this stone and I don't add to the ozone layer. I mean, these are all little behaviors that have been changed.
So what has happened to change the behavior, for example, of your sister to drive the 5 minutes? What do you think that is? Is that coming from the media or just...
I think that is that has to do with loads of different things. First of all, is a sense of empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is a sense of status. And then it's a coolness. So it's this imported American lifestyle in Italy. So you had the people before that went through the passeggio, the struscio, they were just walking around and etc. Now they don't walk anymore, they go with the cars.
Yeah.
And they just go round and around and around for 1 hour night.
Oh, wow.
Along the same strip of road.
Wow.
And they just go, and it's... I just sit down and I think about it sometimes, and I just think, what's wrong with them?
Yeah. And they're showing they have the money to have the car.
The money, the car, and etc. And even if... But it's just the lifestyle. It's just you go there with the car to see your friends and etc. So you have this, like, at least 20 minutes, half an hour of car riding across the same space. And I'm speaking of not even... Probably it's a half a mile road long. It's about half a mile long. And they just go there, and then you take the roads on the other side, the parallel road, you go back to the top, and you do this other half a mile again, and you go up. Mm-hmm. So you take roughly, you do a mile around to be seen for half a mile, and you repeat that for half an hour in the evening, let's say almost every evening, and increases, the time is roughly around 7 to 8, and increases on a Saturday and a Sunday. Mm-hmm. And they're trying with things like blocking the cars on a Sunday, so thereby you have just the place where you just can walk. But still people just come with the cars,
around
park
the
around the edges. And
Well, great. Thank you very much.
I hope you have...
It's July 31st, and I'm in Singapore. I'm speaking with Jeremy Sun Ting Kung from Orca Design about personal climate stories. So can you tell me your personal climate story?
Well, like I said, I never really noticed any significant change, at least where I live. Especially I've been in Singapore for the past 16 years, and it has been always like summertime in Singapore. So you don't really notice that much. Maybe I didn't pay much attention. Mm. To it.
Where did you come from before Singapore?
Taiwan.
Taiwan?
Yeah.
And when was it that you first learned about climate change and first started thinking about it?
Maybe 10 years ago.
Oh yeah? Why was this? That's a long time ago. For most people, it was sooner. It was more recently.
I don't know. Maybe because we're in the design industry and, you know, issues like this usually will be brought up by some people more, you know, in the upfront. Yeah.
Really? How does how have you find the climate issue coming into the design?
Okay, because they're always the more visionary designers. They try to sort of blend in the social issues, community issues into the design, so that there is a lot more thinking into it. And in a way, it's also to try to see design as a profession that actually is part of society building as well. It's not so much, it is designing for commercial success, yes. But at the end of the day, a lot of designers don't really think just that. Yeah.
So can you give me an example of a design project that addressed the climate and community?
Ourselves?
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
we actually did a self-initiated project last year. That was actually in conjunction with the Singapore Design Festival. So we decided to design something. It could be just an idea or something that can be commercialized, but we didn't really care. So we named it the greenhouse effect. So we're not trying to be like the expert trying to resolve the issues, but we're just saying, as a designer, what is our point of view compared to what the others are, you know, having? So we had this our own thought. We think it's important to produce something that is equally inspiring as the normal products, because we don't want it to be like, you know, sacrificing your personal taste, personal preference, and even your lifestyle. So we wanted to have the design that is equally interesting. And at the same time, after you made your choice, you made a natural, greener choice.
Mm. So do you believe that design can have an effect on climate change?
You mean on the positive side or negative?
I don't know, either way.
I think I would say that it has been negative because we help people produce more products, create more desires, which is in a way totally destructive. But with more thinking behind the design, it can be somehow reversed. And we realize design actually communicate quite powerfully or effectively, better than just saying it. For instance, we are always saying that we need to save, but how many people really do saving the resources, whatever? So we design something that is very tiny. You just need to put it around the liquid soap dispenser to prevent the dispenser, or how do you call that?
The nozzle, maybe?
Yeah, to go all the way to the bottom.
Uh-huh.
Which means we cut about one third of your usage without you feeling the stress.
Wow. But so if designers start to reduce consumption, aren't they kind of getting rid of their own jobs? I mean, how can the design industry sustain itself without this idea of more consumption?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Because if we think in a sort of single perspective way, yes, it's true. Because that means that we have run out of things to design. But it's not true, because most of the products that have been designed were designed without environmental consciousness. Which means, if we want to change the way people can consume in this society, we have to revolutionize the way we design. We have to get rid of those products and start adopting design that actually contribute to a better environment and society.
So in a way, right now, there's a big opportunity for designers to completely change. But what happens once things have been completely changed?
I don't think there is a so-called final destination, as in what would be the greenest.
Yeah.
We never know until we reach there.
Yeah.
So it's a continuous process, continuous of innovation, more thinking and more effort. And honestly, if we have reached that day, I would be happy to switch to other jobs. I don't have to be a designer.
Or design things for screen that don't really take up any kind of. But let me ask you, because talking to people earlier, I was talking about why do people not feel the climate change, and one person said it had to do with the memory, that many people forget the way things were, and they feel they're able to adjust to changes in climate, so they think that this is the way that it's always been. So, for example, someone from Singapore was talking about the seasonal rains, and that now the rainy season is not really so pronounced as it was. And so he was talking about how do you get people to remember, and I guess my question is, are there ways that design can be used to help people to remember have more awareness of climate changes in their local environment?
That's a very interesting point, which means there's this value of design that capture your memories and serve as a reminder.
Do you know of any projects that have done that?
Not at this moment.
I know some that are like going back to older ways of doing things and stuff. So just on the idea of personal stories, I wonder if I could ask you about your lifestyle and sustainability of lifestyle, because I think I spent some time in Taipei, which is very similar, very urban, like Singapore, but I think there are some really differences. but I only spent a short time, so I wonder if you could speak to, from a sustainability point of view, lifestyle in Taiwan when you were living there, and then here. Have you found things that are different, that people do things differently, less sustainable, more sustainable?
Probably not much difference during my time and now. But I know that there is some new movement in Taiwan where people are going back to the nature. They're giving up the urban lifestyle. They go back to the hometown to start, you know, cultivating the how do you call it, the kind of lifestyle that is more sustainable.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the good thing about Taiwan is that they have the land to do it.
Oh.
Yeah. That those are mountains and everything.
Right. But
so,
Singapore.
Yeah. Mm. We have only a city. That's it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more difficult.
Mm. And when you were growing up in, did you grow up in Taipei?
Yeah.
So did you go out to the countryside much?
Sometimes.
Uh-huh. And did you see or experience a kind of traditional, sustainable kind of, can you tell me about that maybe? What it's
when
like?
I was a kid, I don't have specific memory of it. Because at the time, it was all about economic growth. Yeah, just that. Yeah.
Mm. And do you think that economic growth is possible with and it is possible to have economic growth and green?
Yeah, it is possible. That's why they're talking about the green industry. Quite some people in Taiwan doing very well in this. They promote a very healthy way of developing the agriculture,
mm-hmm.
at the same time improving the tourism. So it's all integrated at this moment for a few places. Yeah.
And for you, when you think about Taiwan in terms of climate and weather versus Singapore, what do you think about?
I mean, it's definitely more interesting in Taiwan because you have a bit different seasons.
Mm-hmm.
But as you mentioned about the climate change, there is actually climate change happening in Taiwan because, the typhoons are getting really, you know, outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Taichung, they had the biggest flood ever.
Mm.
So I'm sure this has something to do with it. And it has been a problem that, you know, it's never going to go away.
So when you were growing up in Taiwan and it was typhoon season, I mean, were there always typhoons coming through?
Mm.
Every year?
Almost every year, yeah.
Uh-huh. And how did people kind of deal with that? How did people react to the typhoons at that time?
I think for people living in the city, it wasn't really such a big deal because you live in a concrete building, it's pretty safe as long as you're not living in the very low, you know, area.
Okay, right.
Where there's a flood.
Flooding, yeah.
Yeah, that was still okay. But we know that whenever there's a typhoon, there is a big loss to the farmers,
mm-hmm.
that's for sure. It's definitely flooding.
Mm.
The question is, where is the place?
So did it always flood when you were every year? Oh, really?
Somewhere
oh,
in the field or, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a normal kind of a climate.
It's normal.
But now the flooding is so extreme that maybe people are having a hard time addressing it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Especially when the big cities are flooding, then it gets much more serious. Because the loss is not just about the crops and the, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I hope it helps.